online technology is constantly changing the way we organize and think through almost everything. For instance, when did we decide we had to sum up our thoughts in 140 characters? I'm Jim Meadows, and Anne Balsamo, my guest today on Focus, says while technology may be shaping us, we're the ones in control, and we can use technology to design the effects we want. Balsamo's media designs include an online browser for the AIDS Memorial Quilt and a project aimed at increasing mentions of women in Wikipedia and other websites. Anne Balsamo is in town to speak at the University of Illinois, but first she joins us for a conversation on Focus. Our program begins after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest today is Anne Balsamo, and she's an alumna of the University of Illinois, who is currently Dean of the School of Media Studies, as well as a professor of media studies at the New School for Public Engagement in New York City. Anne, welcome to Focus.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Jim.
And, you know, a lot of titles there, but the term that comes to mind for what you actually do seems to be media designer. You've been engaged in designing media really over, you know, a lot of different interests, but if there's a common thread, it seems to be that we are the ones who can be in control of the media we use, which it doesn't always seem to work that way when we look at the mass media and electronic media, digital media is part of that mass media. But when you're, you know, dealing with large companies which are, you know, essentially attracting you because they can make money off of your data, and they're essentially setting the rules as to how you engage with them. That's even though you're using their platforms, you're not in charge quite that way.
Well, that's entirely true. It's actually a kind of a complex scene that we could enter into when we start to engage with, new digital applications, desktop-based applications that provide some measure of creative capacity, enables us to shoot videos, edit videos, create, you know, graphics, sound, audio, soundtracks, and so on. So there is some, you know, some capacity for kind of creative expression and creative kind of making, media making. But of course, the platforms that, you know, that we use and that we kind of receive as, you know, as consumers and so on, those platforms have been, you know, very interestingly shaped in certain ways. They end up kind of structuring what's possible to be done. So the engagement between people as media makers using new technologies is a kind of complex engagement. I'm not sure that I would say we are in control when we're using these new platforms for media making. We do have a kind of measure of agency to engage what we would call the tools of media production in ways that 20 years ago would have been much more difficult because you would have needed whole studios or whole dark rooms to do that kind of work.
Okay. Tonight, you'll be on campus speaking about one aspect of the work you've done. And this is a talk on designing digital memorials. Just to let you know, that's at 7 p.m. tonight. My apologies if you're listening to our 8 p.m. rebroadcast, because it'll be a little too late then. But it is 7 p.m. Monday night at the University of Illinois Library and Information Science Building. That's at 501 East Daniel Street in Champaign. You're all invited to come. But let's talk about that subject right now and the idea of digital memorials. You were showing me a website that you worked on, which is about a way of augmenting the experience of the AIDS Memorial Quilt, which is a project people may not hear as much about now as when it was newer and when the treatments for AIDS were more limited. But the AIDS Memorial Quilt were panels of quilts in memory of people who have died of AIDS. I remember seeing a display of just a few panels of the quilt in Peoria several years ago. There are actually tens of thousands of these panels. And sometimes they have been displayed in large areas, such as on the Capitol Mall in Washington, D.C. But obviously they don't get out much in that size. And the website that you've put together, AIDSquiltTouch.org, tries to give a way in which you can look at those panels.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is an example of what I refer to as an experiment in designing culture that seeks to explore the possibilities of new technologies, not to address technology-driven questions or possibilities, but to think about the process and the possibilities of technological innovation that start with questions of culture rather than questions of technology. And the cultural question that we started with in doing this project to create the digital experiences for the AIDS Memorial Quilt, the cultural question was, how could we use digital technologies to augment the experience of the material form of the quilt in an era when the quilt, and indeed thinking about AIDS and HIV in the United States, when in an era when those topics, AIDS, HIV, the quilt itself, were fading from cultural memory. So the going in question was a question about technology in the service of cultural memory, understanding that the cultural imperative here was the cultural imperative of how do we as a culture take responsibility for remembering and remembering significant chapters, both in our kind of our more delimited notion of culture in the U.S. context, but also the kind of the culture of the global culture of the 20th century. So the going in question for developing these experiences was a cultural question. We then moved on to exploring different kind of technological possibilities, and that's what I'll be talking about tonight, is kind of talking about the design process where we experimented with different technological platforms. The piece that you referred to was our third digital experience that we created. This is a what we call a mobile web app. It's www.AIDSquiltTouch.org. And a mobile web app is an application that runs on any internet-enabled device. It's platform independent, so it doesn't require a particular operating system. It's a reconfigurable website. And what AIDSquiltTouch.org, what that mobile website does is it enables someone to search the quilt image database by name and to see the quilt blocks where people's names are displayed. So you can type in a name of a loved one or someone that you remember who died or might have been commemorated on the quilt, and it will show you the block that their quilt panel shows up on. The motivating kind of impulse for this was the quilt was going to be laid out in the Mall of Washington last summer, and we wanted to provide a mobile web mapping application that would enable people to find the location of a specific panel when it was on the Mall of Washington. And so that's partly something that we understood that the digital could do very well.
So something, the idea is that someone could be walking along the mall with their smartphone in hand, and they could call up a name of someone whose panel they're trying to find.
That's right.
And then find out where to walk.
That's right.
Were you able to get it rolled out in time, and how did it work?
Yes, we were able to get it rolled out in time due to the heroic and pro bono efforts of a team from the University of Iowa, led by John Winnett, who is the director of the University of Iowa Digital Studio for the Public Humanities, who in late April, when I was giving a talk about the digital experiences we were building at Iowa, he said, "You need a mobile web app to do panel location." And I said, "That would be great. We have no resources. We are tapped out in terms of what we're trying to do with a browser and so on and so forth." And he said, "We can do that." So a team from Iowa took about 6 weeks got this mobile web app kind of ready to go, and we launched on June 27th, the very day that the quilt opened as part of the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in Washington last summer.
Were you able to gauge the response? Was this useful for people?
The informal and anecdotal kind of understandings that we have is that it was incredibly useful. It is still up, so it can still be used. It obviously now isn't mapping to quilt panels that are laid out anywhere, but it also includes a digital registry or a digital memorial book, and that has continued to grow. So the only way that people knew about the app was through word of mouth, or if they had come to the mall, because we had postcards, but we really had no formal dissemination mechanism to try to get the word out. I did run a Kickstarter program to try to raise funding for it. Then we did an Indiegogo program to raise funding. So we got the word out that way. But for the most part, this was one of those things that grew virally, which does not necessarily mean massively. Mm-hmm. It grew by word of mouth and through kind of the interest of people who were coming to the mall or coming to the Names Project Foundation, the stewards of the quilt, to find kind of current information about the location of individual panels.
From doing this project, do you see other applications where a format like this might work? And I don't know what else is being done by other people, but the first thing that comes to mind is large cemeteries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, large urban cemeteries, even there's one here in Champaign-Urbana, which isn't the largest cemetery in the world, but it's certainly a place where you could have difficulty finding an individual gravesite. Is that one of the applications that comes to mind, or is that already being done?
I don't think it's yet being done as far as I know. I think that would be a very interesting kind of iteration on this. We had some precedents that we were inspired by, including a really wonderful effort by the Smithsonian Institute and their unit on digital experiences. And their effort was called SOS, Save Outdoor Sculpture. And this was a distributed digital open platform repository that relied on community members to upload images of outdoor sculpture and outdoor art, so public art, permanently installed public art, asking citizens to take on the kind of the role of citizen archivist, to upload an image and to also archive what is the condition of that piece of outdoor sculpture. So Save Outdoor Sculpture was an inspiration for the quilt touch application, because it used that notion of community sourcing that could map then onto things like, you know, Bing Maps or Google Maps and so on.
Okay. Welcome your questions into the mix here about the use of digital media and how you can make it work for you if you think it's working for you or if you think it should be working better. Mm-hmm. Your questions are welcome at 1-800-222-9455. We also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter and online at will-talk@illinois.edu. Again, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Question from Lawrence in Savoy. Lawrence, you're on line one and you're on the air on Focus.
Well, thank you. My question is about the new schools. I've noticed more than one location in Manhattan where they have use of the words new school. My question is, are these all organized under one central head, or are these separate individual areas that have decided to use the name New School?
Hi, Lawrence. Thanks for the question. I've been at the New School for just a little over a year now. And yes, indeed, what you're seeing if you're walking around kind of the West Village area of Manhattan are lots of New School banners. There are actually five New School units. that include the one I'm a part of, which is the New School for Public Engagement. There's also Parsons, the New School for Design, Lang College, the New School for Liberal Arts. So there are five different new schools, but they are all part of the New School, which of course is an old school that got its start in 1919 as the University of the People. And over time, different mergers like with Parsons and so on joined the original New School, which was the New School for Social Research, NSSR. So there are, yes, a number of new schools, five of them, a jazz school, drama school, and so on. But they are all kind of now considered part of the new school,
well,
a university.
Thank you. Let's see if I got this one point correct. The New School for Social Research was the first one to adopt that name?
That was one of the original kind of demarcated new schools. So for many years, it was just called the New School.
Uh-huh.
And then one of the first ones that kind of was identified as with a domain was the New School for Social Research, and that was the umbrella kind of organization for a while. Then there was another one called the Graduate College at the New School. It has a very storied kind of institutional naming history that I'm only just beginning to understand myself.
Well, thank you. Well, one last spin-off question here. So did these, say like the first new school, start up by a conglomeration of certain professor folk and then Parsons decide to take them in, or were they Parsons people that sort of branched out and formed these other areas?
No, the very early contributions and formation of the new school was a group of, again, very illustrious intellectuals, New York intellectuals, who wanted to create a kind of a structure to provide and to engage with issues of education for the people. Much later, 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, other organizations come on board, and I'm not entirely sure what year Parsons actually comes kind of into the New School fold. It was a school of design, and then it became part of the New School.
But Parsons was older than all these others?
I don't know the origins of...
I'm going to direct you to the New School website,
yes,
newschool.edu, and in the About sequence.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And maybe the New School needs an interactive website of its own here to gather a little more information. I wanted to note while we were talking about a digital memorial and what you did with the AIDS Memorial quilt, I went over and I just Googled up a big cemetery, and the one I Googled up was Hollywood Forever,
mm-hmm.
which is a famous and very large cemetery. And it turns out they do have an interactive guide to the show business celebrities in the cemetery, but not everybody in the cemetery. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was able to find out the grave marker for the location of the grave marker for Carl Alfalfa Switzer from the Little Rascals Are Gang films. But that's not quite the same thing, I guess, as if you were trying to find a relative or somebody you knew for a historical reason in a particular cemetery. So that would probably require, in a cemetery like Hollywood Forever, a lot more work.
Well, and, you know, understand there's precedent for that. I mean, Hollywood has had, you know, maps to the stars' homes for, you know, decades and decades and decades. So that's a very Hollywood thing, right? How to map your way to the stars. You know, to get back to the constitution of a map for the AIDS Memorial quilt, let me just make some assertions about the quilt. It was started in 1986. I'm going to talk a little bit about its history this evening, but it is the largest democratically created work of memorialization and folk art in the world, as far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
Which means well before the World Wide Web and the Internet and so on, the quilt was one of the original crowdsourced memorials, where people produced panels based on intensely personal feelings of needing and wanting to commemorate a loved one or someone that they admired. Because many people, of course, did create panels in honor of more famous people who died. But primarily, the people who are commemorated on the panels are people who were important to individuals, to families, to loved ones, to partners, as sons, as daughters, as mothers, as fathers.
It's interesting to think this was actually done before the internet. It has a lot of the markings of things that do get done on the internet. I take it it was much more difficult to do it without that sort of technology available, but yet it was done.
I don't know. I don't know if it was any more difficult than, you know, any kind of grassroots or, you know, organized effort where there's no real central kind of autocratic kind of framework. They establish the beginning construct, the panel size 3 feet by 6 feet, and from there it was a kind of an early example of what we would now understand as, you know, as a cultural meme that went viral, in the sense that the idea of a memorial panel to someone who had died of what in the early days was not yet identified as HIV, but were dying from kind of diseases that seemed to be kind of hitting gay men and the population of gay men quite hard. That construct of commemoration through a quilt panel, that construct really kind of propagated throughout kind of various cultures without the benefits of the World Wide Web or even a large media campaign, advertising campaign. You know, it happened through the social networks that were friendship networks and loved ones and kinship networks. So it's a very interesting and very rich kind of analog precedent for the kind of cultural reproduction that happens now, aided by the internet or the web.
We're talking with Anne Balsamo from the New School for Public Engagement at New York City, and she'll be speaking on designing digital memorials tonight, Monday night, at the U of I Graduate Library and Information Science Building. That's at 501 East Daniel in Champaign. We're going to take a short break right now and be back for more discussion about things you can do online, whether you have somebody's permission or not. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest is Anne Balsamo of the New School for Public Engagement in New York, talking about digital memorials tonight at the U of I Graduate Library and Information Science Building at 501 East Daniel in Champaign, but who has a lot more to say about work using digital media. I want to take a phone call here on line 4, Sharon in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you, Dr. Balsamo, for being back on campus. I wondered if you would speak some about your international work, especially in China. We've talked a lot about how the internet erases boundaries and that kind of thing, but of course we all know that location and regional differences are important too. And I know you've worked with women in China, so I just would welcome some comments about your international work and the challenges and benefits of that. Thank you.
Hi, Sharon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Let me kind of frame that. So this is a little different than the discussion about the kind of digital experiences for the AIDS Memorial Quilt. This moves into another area of research that I've been working on for the past several years on the concept of citizen R&D, or what in the United States I might identify as the cultural formation of DIY culture or maker culture. And I've been, you know, looking at this kind of as I've been trained as a cultural theorist here at University of Illinois, kind of looking at how the notion of a kind of maker's culture, a DIY culture, how that takes shape in different national contexts. And in particular, because of kind of opportunities and colleagues that I have in China, I've had the opportunity to look at kind of the rise of kind of indigenous citizen R&D, research and development, in China over the last 5 to 7 years, working with colleagues there who study a particular kind of cultural phenomenon in China called Shanzai, which is a phenomenon of creating, originally it was bandit kind of products, but in fact it ended up being very much focused on the production of bandit cell phones. So although I'm not the expert in that kind of that cultural kind of form and so on, I've been looking at the kind of the shape of that cultural formation in kind of conversation with the way in which maker culture in the United States has kind of taken form over the last 7 years, just to look at what is the role of the citizen in engaging in desktop now enabled practices of research and development that would enable us not only to do, you know, obviously desktop design of, you know, of digital products, but increasingly desktop enabled design of, you know, three dimensional products. So, you know, desktop CAD systems, easy to use 3D printers and desktop 3D printers. So that's kind of just a broad kind of brushstroke of the work I've been looking at kind of cross culturally or across kind of international context that ties to the broader topic that I think is also an umbrella topic for the Quilt project, which is, you know, how is everyday life kind of lived in this era of participatory culture? So when we are now enabled in interesting ways with new technologies showing up as consumer-grade technologies on our desktops, what are the kind of the creative capacities and the interesting, perhaps more kind of nuanced limitations of these tools and these technologies that come to us that seem to offer us kind of wide creative platforms? And the question is, how are those technologies shaped in different ways by all sorts of other influences? You know, what the things built into the technology, the national context, you know, political programs, you know, policies, intellectual property laws, things like that. So the tie between what I mentioned about the citizen R&D and the Quilt project is really kind of investigating, you know, the kind of nuances of daily life and participatory culture.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about a lot of work you have done trying to give more voice to women in digital culture, online, etc. And that's an area that that you feel that we're really women have not had the voice, even though they certainly use digital media and use online technology and the internet. They aren't their accomplishments and the work they do just aren't as visible in the same way as men.
Let me respond by creating some kind of context around that question.
Certainly.
Which is that when I was early on writing my dissertation here and doing my final chapter, which was on the role and the participation of women and girls in what then was called computer-mediated communication, because we didn't yet have the World Wide Web as a construct, that those early kind of studies, the early research and watching that was the 1989, 1990, 91, the early 90s before the web, it was a very different scene about the number of women participating in online spaces than it is now. those early days, what I was watching was a kind of heavily kind of male populated set of internet sites, and the people participating in the online discussions were certainly heavily identified as male in terms of their monikers and their avatars and so on. That scene changed dramatically throughout the 90s and the 2000s and so on, such that you can't say any longer that women are not, and girls and transgendered and people of color, you can't say that they're not on the web and that their voices aren't there. They are there, and there's a proliferation of very interesting a range of websites that have been started by, you know, young feminists, you know, who might take the moniker of cyberfeminists, or, activists of color who are really focusing on bringing young girls kind of into coding and procedural literacies and so on. The point that we were actually taking on, a group of us, was a much more specific place where it seemed that women, feminist and feminist knowledge and feminist histories of the engagement of feminism, science, and technology, where those identities and those topics were underrepresented, and that more specific kind of site was the popular Wikipedia site. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that we were setting our sights for, you know, all of the web. We were looking kind of very specifically at Wikipedia to you know, kind of understand and kind of get our kind of heads around this lament that Wikipedia doesn't do a very good job in the form of the edited articles that are online now of documenting important scholarly contributions of feminist thinkers to many histories having to do with science and technology. And that kind of lament is a very familiar lament among feminist scholars. You go to you go to a wiki page, the students cite wiki pages, and there's literally no mention of kind of famous women
now,
of any sort.
Now, was that because there was maybe the feminist scholars themselves could be more active on Wikipedia and get the data in there, since this is a large degree of volunteer effort? Or was there some blockage of this information from getting into Wikipedia due to either some built-in biases or just the way that they decide what goes on and what doesn't?
I think there's actually multiple causes that might set up what we see in Wikipedia or don't see in Wikipedia now. A gendered set of practices that...
By a gendered set of practices, what does that mean?
But by that, I would mean that Wikipedia, from its founding about 10 or 12 years ago, has historically been created by male editors. And from the very beginning, it's had very few female editors. That has changed over time, but it's still about 85-90% male editors. So there's a gendered kind of division of labor that is not overtly structured. No one is prohibited from editing Wikipedia. It just becomes a kind of historical kind of tendency that gets reproduced over time. There's some really interesting ways it gets reproduced over time. So there's that. I think there's also a kind of a set of kind of practices that we would like, you know, to encourage young women and feminist scholars to engage in, which is to take seriously the kind of ethical responsibility of archiving the work that's important to us for future generations. So there's a kind of call to feminist scholars and students to as they're also doing new work, to also remember to kind of take seriously our responsibilities for archiving the work that we think is important. This project, though, on Wikipedia and the idea about Wikipedia actually grew into a much bigger effort that I'm going to talk about this afternoon in one of the classes that's going on here, which is to create this online cyber learning experiment that is what we're now posing as an alternative model of MOOC. So,
and for people who are not quite caught up on this, the MOOC, to start out with, is it's a type of mass audience online course.
That's right. So MOOC stands for Massively Open Online Course.
And an example of this might be Coursera, which the University of Illinois existent, for example, is engaged in. It goes beyond their academic courses, and while there may be some credits and certainly knowledge in there, it's aimed at a much larger audience. But you're working with something that you told me is called a doc. And what's the difference between a MOOC and a doc?
So a MOOC focuses on kind of reaching masses, hence the massively open online course. Usually MOOCs, for the most part, offer a singular syllabus by a master instructor who is located at a particular institution. So it will be the master instructor at University of Illinois, the master instructor at Stanford, which is kind of where this kind of phenomenon really kind of got cultural kind of notice, master instructor at MIT, master instructor at Harvard, and so on, where a singular or two instructors working in tandem will deliver a singular syllabus in an open forum such that people from anywhere around the world who have an internet or web connection can log on and take the course. A DOC stands for Distributed Open Collaborative Course, and it was built according to and kind of grounded in a set of kind of feminist principles about feminist pedagogy, about the understanding of the networked construction of knowledge and the co-creation of knowledge. And it really starts with a simple premise, which says, who you learn with is as important as what you learn. And unlike a MOOC, what our DOC is doing, and we're running one now called DOC 2013, Dialogues in Feminism and Technology, a DOC, the 2013 DOC, includes 18 nodal courses. No, I should say it's 23 nodal courses offered at 18 institutions, mostly in the United States.
Are these college credit courses?
These are all college credit courses for the people who are participating in a nodal course at University of Illinois. The nodal course here is taught by C.L. Cole and Sharon Irish. Sharon, who has been an incredibly important organizer of this effort.
So credit courses at the various schools they come from.
That's right. So the DOC doesn't give credit. The individual institutions give credit, mm-hmm. as they would. And then we have, right now, as of now, two at-large nodes, where people are meeting, one group in San Antonio, one group in Massachusetts, who are meeting and convening people who are logging on from all sorts of places and having discussions among people who are not seeking course credit.
Now, there's what I gather, an online network or website that you've developed called which works on this, called FemTechNet. And I'm looking at their Wikipedia entry.
Yes, yes, yes. So so FemTechNet is the name for the organization that has now promoted this cyber learning project. FemTechNet has been around for about 18 months, maybe 2 years, barely. It's a group and started as a group of kind of feminist scholars who were interested in issues of science and technology and networking with one another. We met kind of early on in various kind of conferences and ad hoc kind of meetings and so on, starting to talk about the representation of feminist work in our digital archives, such as Wikipedia, and then grew to understand that there was another kind of feminist innovation that we were percolating, which is taking these networked platforms for online learning and imagining their use as another kind of platform that could be organized differently, not to reach the masses, but to engage a critical mass of people who are distributed across geographic locations, who all want to engage in kind of structured learning and embodied, you know, context-specific conversations on topics having to do with feminism and technology.
Just want to make note, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Our guest is media designer Anne Balsamo, who's speaking this evening at the U of I Library and Information Sciences building that's on West Daniel Street, 7 p.m., particularly on digital memorials. Right now we're talking about a whole a different topic with FemtechNet and the doc that you've put together, the online course. I'm looking at the Wikipedia language. The online course, Doc 2013, is notable not only for its content, but also for its innovative format, which has been described as a new approach to collaborative learning. Much has been made of the ways in which the course is an alternative to the trend towards MOOCs, or massive online open courses inside higher education, characterized it as a feminist anti-MOOC. I'm trying to read your facial expression there, but I do want to note, still time for your questions for Anne Balsamo at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Meanwhile, the feminist website Jezebel looks at the storming Wikipedia assignment, which is the effort to get more information about the role of women in the development of digital media. Jezebel likes it, calls it an awesome attempt to combat Wikipedia's boys' club problem. And I believe it was Mother Jones called it a lady problem with Wikipedia. So it does sound like something that's, well, something that's been talked about.
Right. So I'm cringing at the moniker of the kind of feminist anti-MOOC, because I think from the beginning we were never anti, which was so kind of, you know, you're either this or that. You're either pro-MOOC or anti-MOOC. It's like, well, you can actually, you know, think multiple, like, oh, MOOCs are interesting and they probably serve certain populations very well, you know, when used for certain kinds of kind of course topics. We imagine this as an alternative genre of the online distributed kind of courses. And, you know, so, but it got picked up as kind of the anti-MOOC or but we would like to understand it as an alternative genre of online course. You know, we did focus on Wikipedia, this effort that we call Storming Wikipedia, which is an effort that all of the courses, the 23 nodal courses, are going to participate in some way. It addresses a very timely topic, which has recently, since last summer, has been often referred to as Wikipedia's woman problem, that got kind of headline or captured headlines because of an incident during the summer where one experienced Wikipedia editor decided that the female authors who were listed in the and on the webpage American novelists, that the female authors should not be listed on that page, that they should be only listed on a page called American Women Novelists. And so this editor, this experienced editor, ended up taking women authors, novelists in the U.S. context, taking them off of the kind of more general page.
So like removing, I don't know, Willa Cather or Edna Ferber and just putting them in another list somewhere.
Right. And to find them only by the kind of the moniker of, you know, American women authors, which then meant, of course, that American authors was to be ungendered, but of course was gendered male.
Uh-huh.
And this created an uproar because it was you know, done by someone, you know, I'm not going to go into the details, who didn't have any real kind of scholarly rationale for that. There was not a companion page kind of created for American male authors. So it started a furor.
I'm trying to imagine, especially if would you have done the same thing with English authors and put Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters over in one separate category, and would you have missed them if they were gone from the main list?
Well, you, I mean, certainly if someone was going to, you know, notable American authors, and if they were, you know, a young mind or somebody who's not well, you know, well-versed in literary history, and if they would have seen only a list of male authors, how would they have known mm-hmm. to go to another page called American Women Authors?
What came of this particular controversy? Did that list survive, or were the women restored to the main list?
They were both. Both the new page for American Women Authors still exists, and then they were restored to the original page of the American Authors.
Okay. And meanwhile, how have things been doing? I mean, I'm looking at, for instance, the FemTechNet. It was only mm-hmm. Only set up this year. All pretty new. How are things going as far as trying to get your information out there?
Well, we're very excited in the sense that we have more than 300 people participating in these nodal courses and the at-large courses, and they are all kind of engaging in kind of discussions, both kind of face-to-face discussions in their different kind of geographic locations, but also starting and poised to start kind of engaging in cross-domain conversations. Today, September 23rd, we are launching the first of our 12-week video series. The video series is called Video Dialogues, Dialogues on Feminism and Technology. And today we launch with the first episode in the series, which is an interview with Judy Weissman, who's a professor of sociology at the London School of Economics and one of the founding figures in the area of feminism and technology studies. And her video, it's a 30-minute video, is the first of 12 videos. We will release one video each week. Each video addresses a different topic.
This is available at the FemTechNet website?
Yes. So if you just go to www.femtechnet.org, and you'll see the featured video of the week, and all the videos eventually will be archived
okay.
there.
Okay. Well, just a few minutes left. Let's take a call on line one from Amy in Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. Good morning. I'm so excited to hear you on the radio and to have you in town. I really appreciated your work, Professor Balsamo, for so many reasons, but particularly because you really challenge the idea that technology is neutral and natural in its form, and the maleness and whiteness associated with technology is something that you really shine a light on. I've seen it's not natural. It's really shaped and coded by our culture, and I just love your work, and I'm so excited you're here. But I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the storming Wikipedia effort within this framing, because I think one of the questions the host brought up is a common question that comes up that maybe females are not represented, and you touched on this, but I was hoping to go a little further, that maybe females aren't represented on Wikipedia in the entries because they're just not working hard enough to get their work out there. And it's a very neoliberalist claim, but maybe women aren't doing enough, and that's why they're left out of history. But I know your work clearly goes beyond this individual analysis and says that, you know, history is not an individual problem. It's a cultural, very contextual issue. With technology also, how we understand it is not just individual, but it's very cultural, contextual. So I'm hoping you could just talk a little bit about that, how the work that you're doing with Wikipedia takes this infrastructure into account and to address some of the issues that people might have about it being an individual issue.
And Anne, I'm afraid
I'll take it offline. Thank you.
Thank mm-hmm. you very much, Amy. And Anne, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to do it in about a minute's time.
Okay, so it's the Storming Wikipedia project focuses not only on women and feminists doing new kinds of work, entering Wikipedia, but also trying to reach the men, male editors who are probably unconsciously or unaware of kind of different citation practices. So, for example, you go to the site, the page on midwifery, you'll see two male sociologists identified by name and by institution, and the kind of primary feminist scholar, feminist historian on midwifery, Barbara Ehrenreich. She's cited, but she's cited in a footnote, so her name doesn't appear, and her footnote doesn't even link to her page on Wikipedia. Now, that's a really simple kind of example where it's not about overt bias. She's there. But it is about certain kinds of authoring practices that would suggest we need to be more thoughtful about our citation practices.
Okay. Well, we're just about running out of time. I do want to note your address tonight. Anne Balsamo from the New School for Public Engagement, speaking on designing digital memorials at 7 p.m. tonight at the U of I Graduate Library and Information Science Building at 501 East Daniel Street on the U of I Urbana-Champaign campus. If you want to find out more about FemTechNet and storming Wikipedia, you can either go there and pepper her with questions after the talk, and go to the FemTechNet website. Again, that's femtechnet.org. Okay. Well, thank you very much. An hour is not enough for this subject matter, and I suspect if I were to reach you in about a year's time, you'll have a lot more to talk about in the FemTechNet efforts. I want to thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Tuesday on Focus, we may be high tech, but we still need nature, and in some basic ways, too. Richard Louv will come on the show to talk about the nature principle and how many of us are suffering from nature deficit disorder, and about the new nature movement. Focus is live each Wednesday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. This is Focus on WILL.